exciting for me to give a presentation that's a little bit different than normal. This is technical inputs onto politics for the International Treaty on Plant Genetic Resources for Food and Agriculture. So it's a little departure. It is science, let's say, but it's for political purposes. And I hope it's interesting to you all. So interdependence among countries in plant genetic resources is a primary concept that's been used in the formation of the International Treaty on Plant Genetic Resources. What does interdependence mean? In essence, and very simply, that countries need each other to exchange genetic resources in order to support their agricultural systems. Why? Because we grow food essentially from around the world, whose genetic resources come from around the world, so sharing with each other is helpful and important in terms of long-term resilience of our agricultural system. For those unfamiliar with the treaty, in short, it's about 10 years young now, so it's our newest, let's say, international treaty around the world. It's specifically about genetic resources for food and agriculture. It's been signed by 135 countries or so, plus the EU. The US has signed but not yet ratified, and therefore in sort of the process of perhaps ratifying it soon. And in essence, it's about direct commitments around the world on the national level to conserve genetic resources and then to share them. And that sharing part is called the multilateral system for access to genetic resources. That multilateral system is, in essence, a prearranged system of being able to exchange genetic resources with those benefit-sharing mechanisms and access already sort of worked out. Interdependence is the primary sort of focus of the foundation of that, because of the idea that we all need each other, so we might as well make it easy to share our resources. 20 years ago or so, there was an input paper before the treaty existed, but fundamental in starting the treaty, that was an estimation of how dependent or interdependent we are around the world on genetic resources by Jimena Flores Palacios. And the difficulty at that time, which unfortunately still exists, is that we don't have really good solid data about germplasm flows around the world. That might be surprising. In fact, the data does exist. It's very often just difficult to access. And so this paper from 20 years ago said, okay, if we don't know exactly who's exchanging and where it's going, then we'll come up with an estimate of how interdependent we are around the world. And in fact, it was very, it was a strong argument for starting the treaty. And so what did she do? Well, it's based on the idea that genetic resources are richer in some places than others in the long-term evolutionary sense. That is, we know that crops come from certain places originally, like potatoes in the Andes, and because those crops were initially domesticated there and evolved over hundreds to thousands of years, that a lot of genetic diversity developed their varieties, but also of their crop wild relatives, that is, over then hundreds to thousands or millions of years, in essence. And so, even though that's where crops come from, now crops are important not only in those places, but in many other places around the world. And in fact, many of us, including myself at the International Center for Tropical Agriculture, are involved with making crops more important outside their regions of diversity, whether that's beans in East Africa, cassava in Southeast Asia, or rice in the Americas. And so her method was very simple. It was assessing for each country, in a very simple way actually, what that country eats, and how much of that diet comes from crops essentially from the region that the country is in, and how much of the diet comes from somewhere else. And the argument is, the more your diet comes from somewhere else, in the long-term sense, the more you're sort of interdependent in terms of genetic resources in the long-term food security sense. Does that make any sense, or should I repeat that? Yeah, good. Okay, so that was 20 years ago, and we decided to sort of redo the effort, partly because the effort was old, but partly because it was very superficial. So we did sort of an enhanced version of it. First, we needed to come up with where are these regions where crops originally come from. And it's an expanded, or let's say a liberal version, because it's about genetic resources. So we call them primary regions of diversity. It's where they're initially domesticated, but where a large amount of the diversity is sort of evolved over time, including crop wild relatives. Some of you, of course, as experts, will argue with me because of course, it's an uncertain boundary with all of these things. And crop-wild relatives, of course, can be in other locations. For instance, rice has some crop-wild relatives in the Americas and such. But you need to cut it at some point in a certain manageable level of sort of, this is where the greatest amount of genetic diversity of a crop comes from. So we did that. It's more crops than are on this list, but this is sort of what we could fit onto a pretty map. So that was our first step. Second step was then connecting what people eat and actually what people grow in their countries to where those crops come from. And we were inspired by the genomics community with using these CIRCOS diagrams to try to map this. And let me break it down for you, because it seems confusing, but hopefully you'll find it powerful. These regions that we show, there's about 23 regions, primary regions of diversity of crops. These are these regions that you see around. We're going to show diets for calories. So how do we do this per region? We have national level data on what people eat. That's sort of an average diet in the United States and Canada, et cetera. And then for a region like North America, we took a weighted average across those countries and made it into a regional average diet. Weighted average by population. So the US's diet is a little more weighted than Canada's diet for North America there. Okay, so this is dietary. What is eaten in those regions, and then where are those crops' primary regions of diversity? Not where are those crops grown. Where are those crops' primary regions of diversity? And so we start to map the flows. You need to look at the colors to understand where the flows come from. So if the color comes from a region, that's Central America and Mexico, and it flows down to Southern Africa, this is the portion, this is just the most important at the moment, but the portion for calories of the Southern African diet of crops that originally come from there. So any guesses of what those crops might be for Southern Africa that are so important? It's one particular crop. Good. There's a lot of suggestions. That's maize. By far the most important caloric source in Southern Africa at this point. The other two things that you see strongly are basically wheat, although it's not just one crop. So the crops that are native to sort of the Fertile Crescent, Western Asia and stuff, but primarily wheat, barley, these other things that are important in those regions, but also already seem to be important in Europe, in Australia, New Zealand, and in other regions. And then you see the importance of rice. So basically, you're already seeing how important our three biggest crops in the world are in terms of calories and connecting them. But that's just the beginning. If you start to map our entire diet and where these crops come from and connect us, then you end up with our web of diversity in terms of what we eat and where those crops sort of originally come from around the world. This is hopefully the big, powerful message that we are sort of interdependent, if you follow our argument, about long-term food security and genetic resources. We did this for calories. We also did this for protein in the diet from plants, and also fat from plants. And this one might be a nice one just to look at for a second. One of the biggest flows you see is this blue. It's native resources from Eastern Asia that is important for fat in diets in tropical South America and in North America. Any guesses as to what one particular crop? Soybean, exactly. So you can see how strongly important soybean is. Not just grown in those are the two biggest producing regions in the world as well, but in terms of our calorie, or in terms of our fat and food weight. Okay, so that's the argument about diets, but diets are complicated by one major factor, which is we don't just eat what we produce, we also import food. And so if we're talking about genetic resources and national production and interdependence, then maybe it's more important to look at what we produce in countries. So we again, for all the countries in a region, put them together. We didn't take an average, we just added them together. This is total tons of food produced, for instance, in tropical South America. So all the countries added together. Yeah? And I'll just show this flow, because it's the biggest one. Again, you see these two blues that come from here and from here. So these are crops that are native to South Asia, Southeast Asia, and are so incredibly dominantly important for production of tons in tropical South America. Three major crops. Tons of food produced. Rice, definitely. Sugarcane. By far the biggest production in total tons in the world of any crop, actually. One other. Bananas and plantains. This is the last one. We did this for harvested area, and finally for production value. So hopefully you'll get the point that, the argument is that we are highly interdependent. And as genetic resources people, you knew that already. So preaching to the choir. Because that's a little bit difficult to quantify, we did that a little bit easier on the national level by coming up with a metric more like Flores Palacios, that's simply how much of your diet is crops that come from your own native primary region of diversity, how much comes from elsewhere. And from zero is that you're eating your totally only your native traditional diet, let's say. And one is 100% eating crops that come from elsewhere. This is calories. So this is in your diet, how much of the crops that you're eating are from foreign primary regions of diversity, as we call it. And you do see a geographic change. Of course, the more temperate areas of the world and islands are more dependent, let's say, on elsewhere. And you get this strip in the middle that's a little bit more native. But the big essence is that there's nobody in the world that's just eating their own native genetic resources and nothing else, let's say. And that we also did on the production side, and you get a similar trend. And I put a couple of numbers for all seven metrics there at the bottom, just for the U.S., Mexico, and Canada, just so you get a little bit of a feel. So for instance, for the United States in terms of calories, and in fact in our full paper, which there's a citation at the end, you'll see there's a variance metric there, but to make it simple, I give you one number here, and that is that the U.S. is about 90% eating food whose primary regions of genetic diversity are elsewhere in the world. Mexico a little bit less for calories, but pretty high for things like production quantity. We did quite a few metrics to try to associate and understand this dynamic over time. The full paper is a good place to go to understand it. Since I just have a few minutes, I'll just talk through. We also looked at change over time in this metric of dependence on foreign genetic resources. And in fact, it has increased over time as a mean across the world. These lines are countries. And the bottom axis, the x-axis there, is change in the last 50 years. And that's our dependence metric again. So we're getting more and more, we're eating more and more foreign genetic resources, let's say, if you want to simply say that. And we're also producing more and more foods whose genetic resources are from elsewhere. We also did an association about diversity. In essence, the argument is pretty simple. Again, it's the more diverse your diet is, or the more diverse your production systems, also it ends up being the case that the more you're eating or producing food whose genetic resources are primarily from elsewhere. And we did an association with GDP, which is a little more complicated, but in essence, the higher your GDP as well, the more you're interdependent on the system of eating foods from foreign resources, foreign areas. So, key results. No country is fully independent of eating foods from elsewhere around the world. On the national average, we're about 70% dependent on foreign genetic resources, and this is increasing over time. One last point to make very quickly is that our treaty as it stands, or the multilateral system, doesn't yet incorporate this understanding completely of interdependence. This is a metric we came up with, is how important the crops are, simply how big that spider diagram. Not to worry about it. The important is whether it's blue or red. If it's blue, it's already part of the system of sharing and access, or theoretically sharing and accessing genetic resources. If it's a red crop, it's not yet in the system. And the point is that we've got quite a bit to go in terms of understanding which crops that are really important around the world. These are the last papers. They're both online if you just Google them, and you'll sort of get the whole metrics and all of the figures and all that. Thanks very much.